It's taken under advisement. You're next in the case, your argument next in the case of United States against Garner.
May it please the Court, my name is Eric Ives. I'm a senior law student at the University of Chicago Law School, arguing pursuant to Local Circuit Rule 34H, and I represent defendant appellant James W. Garner, Jr. Mr. Garner's conviction should be overturned or, in the alternative, sentence vacated and remanded as a result of errors committed at trial and sentencing. At a minimum, Mr. Garner's sentence should be vacated, as the district court specifically considered Mr. Garner's decision to plead not guilty and exercise his constitutional right to do so in direct violation of the United States sentencing guidelines by considering this decision to plead not guilty as a basis for imposing an obstruction enhancement. The United States sentencing guidelines specifically prohibit courts from considering a defendant's denial of guilt or decision to plead not guilty as a basis for the application of an obstruction enhancement, and the district court in this case violated this specific prohibition. A fair reading of the sentencing transcript, as quoted in its entirety in our reply brief, demonstrates that the improper factors considered by the district court constituted a basis for the imposition of the obstruction.
Do I take it from your turning straight to sentencing that you're not planning to discuss the ineffective assistance claim?
No, Your Honor. I am planning on discussing the chronic claim. I was hoping to discuss briefly, but I will.
Comes first.
Sure.
I'm going to ask you the question I ask of everybody who makes an ineffective assistance claim on appeal, which is whether you really want to do so.
Yes, Your Honor, we do.
Have you discussed with your client the fact that if an ineffective assistance claim is made now and rejected now, it can never be raised again on a more complete record?
Your Honor,
one bite at the apple. It can be on direct appeal or on collateral attack, but you and your client should know that in the history of this court, which was established in 1891, the number of reversals based on ineffective assistance claims on direct appeal is zero.
Yes, Your Honor, we realize that. However, we argue
why would you want to raise this now? Isn't it ineffective assistance to raise an ineffective assistance claim now?
No, Your Honor. We have discussed this case both internally and with our client and determined that a decision to contest the ineffective assistance counsel under specifically and only under the chronic standard for ineffective assistance.
I just want to make sure that you understand that if you make a chronic argument now, no ineffective assistance claim of any kind under any heading supported by any facts can ever be raised later.
Yes.
Ever.
Yes, Your Honor, we understand,
we'll understand
that.
That.
We understand
I,
that, Your
I
Honor.
Think that I'm certain that Judge Williams also shares Judge Easterbrook's and my concern about this, because you, I mean, without speaking to either of them, because you yourself in the briefs have said that the trial record is incomplete as a result of trial counsel's performance. And what we really need to think about, I suppose, here is whether or not this is really a chronic situation. Mr. Garner's attorney may have mounted a very limited defense to counts 1 and 2, but in part, surely, in this particular case, that was dictated by the evidence. Mm-hmm. I mean, the government has him on videotape and audio tape, essentially confessing his guilt to these charges. Isn't that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. However, it's important, and I think this also answers Judge Easterbrook's question of why we bring this claim now, is that under the chronic standard, we argue that counsel completely failed to act as an adversary to the prosecution. Counsel conceded, and yes,
I think your probability of success on that claim is not distinguishable from zero by epsilon.
Well, I understand Your Honor's concern with that. However, it's an issue of first impression in
before
this court.
Not an issue of first impression. It was squarely rejected by the Supreme Court in Bell.
Your Honor, if I may respectfully disagree, Bell versus Combs.
You can respectfully disagree all you want, but the probability is arbitrarily close to zero. We're trying to give you the best help we can.
Your Honor, I understand and I appreciate your concern.
Is this something you want to think about?
No, Your Honor, it's not. I really, if I may have an opportunity to state why I believe that this is a different issue than presented by Bell versus Cohn or Florida versus Nixon, because it deals with the counsel's concession of guilt in a multi-count claim on two of the three counts presented at trial. Bell versus Cohn and Florida versus Nixon both dealt with different situations in which, in Bell versus Cohn, counsel specifically, the claim was that counsel failed to present evidence at sentencing. A failure to present evidence at sentencing does not deal with counsel's concessions of guilt and therefore abdication of counsel of prosecution's entire burden of proof to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that counsel is guilty.
I think you should turn to another point because you're not going to convince us on this point.
Yeah.
Really. I mean,
give you 10 days following oral argument to inform us whether you really want to pursue this claim.
I understand, Your
Perhaps
Honor.
Perhaps consulting with your client in light of the court's observations will be helpful.
We have done that consultation previously, but I will bring Your Honor's concerns to our client. Turning to another issue, though, and the issue that I began with, the defendants or the district court's specific consideration of inappropriate factors in the sentencing hearing requires this court to remand the case for resentencing in conjunction with this court's decisions in Barrett and Bathoon, in which the incorrect application of the sentencing guidelines reviewed de novo by this court, if applied incorrectly, require this court to remand the case for resentencing. In this case, the district court specifically violated Section 3C1.1 of the sentencing guidelines by considering and explicitly considering Mr. Garner's decision to exercise his constitutional right to plead not guilty as a basis for imposing an obstruction enhancement. As the transcript stated, the district court labeled Mr. Garner's not guilty plea as, and I quote, a reluctance here on the part of Mr. Garner to recognize error.
Now, I certainly agree with you that Judge Randa's remarks could have been a lot more clear than they were, but isn't it reasonably clear that Judge Randa believed that the enhancement was warranted because Mr. Garner had perjured himself on the stand and he had attempted to suborn perjury?
It's very unclear, as Your Honor herself stated, that whether or not the district court actually based its finding on those statements, or those statements or those telephone records. However, to quote the district court in its final judgment on the obstruction enhancement claim, the district court stated, and I quote, if the court was making a ruling, and I suppose it has to, it wouldn't find the enhancement is undue. The vagueness of this statement is apparent. However, what isn't vague is that the district court specifically and explicitly considered as a basis for the obstruction enhancement factors that are prohibited from consideration by the sentencing guidelines, including Mr. Garner's decision to plead not guilty in this case. Furthermore, the district court even went so far as to chastise Mr. Garner for having taken a mere 48 hours to decide whether or not to plead guilty in a completely unrelated previous case. To quote that, the district court labeled this as a reluctance to admit one's guilt and compared that to the situation in this case. Furthermore, and most importantly, Mr. Garner's decision to exercise his constitutional right to plead guilty or to plead not guilty in this case was explicitly considered. And to quote again, I know I labeled it once, but the district court's consideration was extensive on this. The district court labeled this decision to plead not guilty as, and I quote, a huge black spot and a failure to recognize the real deficiencies when it comes to fessing up. These explicit considerations by the district court were first and foremost in its analysis. It went directly from stating that it will now turn to the obstruction issue to then considering a lack of verification of educational background, which is a factor prohibited from consideration under Section 3C1.1 as it is irrelevant to an issue of obstruction. Then it goes on to consider Mr. Garner's decision to plead not guilty in this case, which is specifically prohibited as it serves, as the application note states, to punish a defendant for the exercise of his constitutional right. And then only after considering and chastising Mr. Garner for taking a mere 48 hours to decide to plead guilty in a previous case, the district court then, only then, vaguely references Your Honor's statements in which whether or not Mr. Garner suborned or perjured himself. And these explicit considerations and violations of United States sentencing guidelines require this court to remand the case for resentencing in conjunction with the United States sentencing guidelines.
Now, it's true he doesn't go into any detail. He says he heard the tapes and the attempt to suborn perjury, but when you look at that document, it's pretty clear that's what he was doing, isn't it? When he says, all I need is for him to come down here and say that the pistol was his.
Your Honor, I see my time is concluded. Would you care for me to answer your question?
Yes, please.
Yes. Those vague statements by the district court with reference to the statements of suborning perjury do have some basis in the record. However, this court is specifically required in Lozoya versus and Morales that a district court must make an independent finding of what basis constituted, or make a basis and an independent finding for the obstruction enhancement. This court's statements in its sentencing hearing fall well below that standard. And in addition, the fact that the district court in Lozoya required an explicit independent finding highlights the fact that the district court's consideration of the not guilty plea is even more warranted for a remand, as the requirement for an independent finding is based on the fact that it attempts to protect the defendant's exercise of his constitutional rights to plead not guilty or to testify in this case. And so surely an explicit consideration of those factors, where an implicit consideration is prohibited by Lozoya, an explicit consideration should also be prohibited. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Ives. Ms. Hoffman.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Gail Hoffman. I represent the United States of America. I also represented the United States of America at trial in this matter. I will turn towards the sentencing argument made towards counsel, and I would point out that on both issues, whether or not Mr. Garner himself committed perjury and whether he suborned perjury, the judge did make an explicit finding. In the government's brief, appendix 28, which is page 48 of the sentencing transcript, the court said in reference to pleading not guilty, and there is no problem, there is everyone has a right to plead not guilty. You're advised of that, and you exercise that right. But that doesn't give one the right to come to court and tell something that's totally way out of whack, way out of line. And what had happened at trial is that the defendant had testified that Tom Sankey, who had purchased the High Point firearm, that the defendant specifically stated, Tom was in my van, it was Tom's gun. And that statement by the defendant was completely contrary to every piece of evidence that had been produced at trial. Seymour Samuel testified that the gun was Mr. Garner's. Thomas Sankey himself testified that he straw purchased the gun, one for Mr. Seymour Samuel, and then one again for...
I don't believe that straw purchase is a verb.
Well, he purchased on behalf of another. He purchased the High Point on behalf of Mr. Garner. In addition, Mr. Garner's own words were presented to the jury, which the court heard. There were a series of tape-recorded conversations that were introduced at trial. And in those conversations, not only did the defendant admit that he possessed the High Point, in one particular tape, he talks about where he always put the gun when If it wasn't on his person, then he put it in one particular place in the van. So the defendant himself admitted that. His testimony at trial was completely contrary to the testimony of other witnesses and his own words. So the court did make a finding on that. With respect to suborning perjury, again, as set out in the government's brief and introduced at trial, there are a whole series of tape-recorded conversations that were introduced in evidence where Mr. Gardner talked to either Diane Pittman, the mother of several of his children, or his mother about the need for Mr. Sankey to come to court and to take ownership of that particular pistol. The record was complete with those conversations. So there is no other logical inference. And as the court had previously stated in another oral argument, the court is in the business of logic. There is no other logical conclusion that the defendant attempted to suborn perjury. With that, absent any questions from the court.
I do have a question, because not every false statement under oath is perjurious, only false statements about a material issue. How is the issue of who owned the gun material to the prosecution? Is that an element?
Well, the government has to prove possession of that particular pistol, and the government's assertion was that it was possessed by Mr. Garner. Mr. Garner claimed that the gun was not his and that he didn't realize it was there, that Mr. Sankey had, in fact, left it in his van. Mr. Sankey testified he had never been in Mr. Garner's van and that the pistol was not his. He had purchased it on behalf of Mr. Garner, but it was not his. So, in fact, it is a material fact because it is an element of the crime. Absent any further questions, the government rests on its submissions.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The case is taken under advisement.